Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're reconnecting with a couple of infectious disease experts who we spoke with 3 weeks ago for a live Q&A on coronavirus. Emily Spivak is Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases with University of Utah Health. And Lindsay Keegan is an epidemiologist with the University of Utah's School of Medicine. So how much more do we know about the virus 3 weeks later? And what can we know about what our future with coronavirus holds? Dr. Emily Spivak and Dr. Lindsay Keegan, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
So 3 weeks ago, this was kind of a hard question to answer, and it may still be. Where are we in all of this? I mean, both in Utah, but also nationally and globally, are we somewhere near the beginning, nearer to the end? Is there an end to even think about? What can we say there?
So we're definitely still near the beginning, especially here in Utah. I just want to say thank you to everyone out there because we've actually been doing a really great job with social distancing. We're starting to see, as other states take off and explode in their outbreak, Utah has managed to keep this at much more manageable levels. And that's entirely due to our efforts as a state to improve social distancing. So everyone, give yourself a pat on the back, but don't stop doing what you're doing. If anything, do it more, do it longer. We're just at the beginning of this. And, compared to some of the other states, which are peaking much more rapidly, seeing much higher rates of growth, you know, we're at a slower, earlier stage, which is good. But keep in mind that the second we let up, we will end up on the track that some of those other states do. Globally, we're starting to see some countries come down. So South Korea has managed to get things under control for the most part. As we can tell, China has managed to get things under control. Italy's starting to come down. You know, we're starting to see the end of the first wave for some of the early countries. That's not to say that that's the end of the epidemic. We may, unless we essentially hit 50 to 70% of the population getting infected, we do expect another wave to come unless we can get a vaccine out there. So we're sort of in this early stage here in the U.S., maybe an early to mid stage in some other countries.
And Dr. Spivak, do you have anything to add there? That was Dr. Lindsay Keegan speaking.
No, I would totally agree with Dr. Keegan. And I would echo, I have significant concerns about complacency. I watch our testing within the university system and the state side every day. And our testing is dropping off. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, if that's a good thing, a bad thing, what that represents. But, you know, in the hospital, our cases, I look every day, sort of hanging at the same number of inpatients, so the most sick patients every day. There is not by any means a climb in the number of hospitalizations that we're having. And I think this is good. And to echo Dr. Keegan, I think it's because of the social distancing that people have enacted. But I do worry as time goes by, people are going to become complacent. And I worry about social distancing being lifted and people not realizing that we are in the situation we're in, as she said, because of the early implementation of social distancing. And it is even more important than ever to continue that, or we will have a spike.
Meaning there could be a sort of bounce back. If we send the wrong message and people begin to congregate again, we may see the resurgence of the virus and the same problem that we are trying to avoid.
Not a may or a could. We will.
We
most definitely know that that is what will happen. There's no question that as soon as we relax these social distancing measures, things will bounce back unless we are hitting the levels that South Korea was hitting in terms of testing and isolating, which we know we're not at yet. People are working very hard to get there, but right now, if we lift the social distancing measures tomorrow, we will be in the place that Florida is or New York is in a matter of weeks. It is not a question of if, it is a definite that social distancing is what's keeping us from being in that scenario.
Another question that I have, and it's something that I asked you 3 weeks ago as well, and I don't know if we have any further information on it, but do we know whether those who get sick and then recover develop any kind of immunity, and to what extent they do? Do we have a better answer to that question yet?
I think, so this is Dr. Spivak, I think there is, we have a slightly better sense, but we, in a nutshell, don't have the answer yet. So there are antibody, so blood tests that have, one that has been FDA approved to look for, again, blood evidence and antibody in folks who have recovered to see if they have evidence that their immune system has seen the virus. We do not know if this antibody, we don't have great evidence yet that it correlates with immunity. It probably does based on what we know about other respiratory viruses in the past, but we don't have solid evidence that it does. We also don't know sort of what I would call the kinetics or the lifespan of that antibody and how long, if it is protective, it stays around and would provide some immunity. Again, realizing that we are a vulnerable population, it's important to know how long that immunity might be there to think about sort of how we would protect the population. I will say that ARUP is working on an antibody test, and I'm not going to give any dates, but is working on rolling that out, realizing again that it would probably most importantly be used as a sort of public health test. We've come up with some different clinical situations in which we might use it, but we don't really know if it correlates that well or how well it correlates with immunity, and it would be better used as a sense of giving us a sense of how much of the population may have been exposed to this virus already, because again, our testing is, I don't want to say limited, but we haven't tested large swaths of the population, so it may give us more of a sense of how widespread the virus actually has been.
More of a picture, and then I guess it would be used for researchers, for scientists like yourself, and less for individuals who might think that having done an antibody test, they could then, you know, look, I've been exposed, so I'm okay to go out there now. We can't say that, right?
Can't say that. And I do think that is a concern, again, thinking about social distancing and that's been what we think is most effective. There is probably some role for thinking of its use in healthcare workers who need to go back out there. And we've not had a surge here, and hopefully we won't have a large one, but we are concerned about our supply of healthcare workers because they may get sick or need to be out of work for childcare or other reasons. An antibody test may help us think about who may have already been exposed and who we can pull back into work if they've already been exposed, if we start to get into a resource limited situation.
Got it. I guess it depends on whether or not you have developed some degree of immunity, or, you know, if you've had this and recovered. Is the virus changing enough, you know, morphing enough for a different strain of it to still be dangerous, even if you've had an earlier iteration of the virus and recovered? Does that make sense? You know, like, is COVID-19 going to change and come back in waves like a seasonal flu does?
This is Dr. Keegan. So this is outside of my area of expertise, but from what I'm understanding, what I'm hearing from colleagues who understand this better than I do, COVID-19 is mutating rather slowly, which is beneficial for developing a vaccine. However, we do know that other coronaviruses remain in circulation. So either we're losing immunity to them or they're mutating sufficiently to escape our immune system. I'm not sure which of those two or what combination, how those two combine together. But from an epidemiologic standpoint, we're planning there to be multiple waves. Even if you just looked at pandemic 1918 influenza, there were three waves of the 1918 flu. That went on for about a year and a half. It wasn't just 1918. And so we need to prepare, regardless of long-term how this plays out, you know, 5-10 years down the road, we need to prepare that we're in this current fight for months, year and a half. Like, we need to be thinking, this is not in 2 weeks everything's going to be fine. I mean, even if we get everything completely under control in Utah and we've gotten rid of all cases, we live in a global society and there's a pandemic spreading throughout the globe. We need to be prepared for reimportations into the state, and we need to essentially develop a long-term strategy of how we're going to deal with this. And if we look to countries that have handled this epidemic without massive totalitarian shutdowns or without totally overwhelming the health systems, that leaves us looking at South Korea, which was a comprehensive test and isolate strategy where everyone with symptoms was tested, was isolated, all of their close contacts were tracked down, those contacts were repeatedly tested to ensure that they didn't contract the virus, and if anyone who did was then isolated. So we need to figure out how we adapt a strategy like that to Utah. that will be the only way we go forward without massive shutdowns, long-term shutdowns, or massively overwhelming health systems. And so I think it's important to think, you know, what's going to happen 5 years down the road? How is this virus evolving? But more importantly, it's important to think, what are we going to do for the next 6 months?
And Dr. Spivak, I mean, I'm part of what I'm hearing from Dr. Keegan is this, it sounds like the one crucial thing is then, you know, we have this long-term sort of holding pattern while we work on developing something like a vaccine. I guess, you know, with the, this is just a sort of side note, but the seasonal flu, you have a different vaccine essentially every season that it comes back because you have a different strain of the flu. Is that, does anybody know whether or not that's something that we might be looking at long-term for this novel coronavirus? I mean, I know there are other coronaviruses that have been out there for some time, this particular coronavirus.
So not being a vaccinologist nor a virologist, I'm not so sure I can answer that question.
Sure.
And I think the easy answer is it's too early to know. And to Dr. Keegan's point, I mean, I've heard the same thing, that based on the genetic analysis, strain analysis that has been done, a lot of this work in Seattle and University of Washington, there does not seem to have been significant genetic changes in the SARS-CoV-2 strains that are circulating within the US or even within the globe that to any significant degree yet. And it's probably too early to know. And again, without being a vaccinologist or a virologist, knowing, I think what specifically the vaccine is targeting sort of immunity-wise on the virus probably depends on sort of if that is something that is susceptible to genetic changes seasonally. So the simple answer is it's too early to know. But I would be optimistic that hopefully it would not require repeated vaccinations, but too early to know.
Okay. I've got a list of questions that I want to keep getting through before we run out of time. And so I'm going to move us along. And, you know, this is a highly contagious disease. It's dangerous, especially for certain populations. We are all trying to both protect ourselves and each other. And on that front, some of the health advice has changed since we spoke 3 weeks ago. There are stricter measures in place, stay-at-home directives or public orders in some places. The CDC says that, you know, when we go into places where social distancing isn't all that easy, we should be wearing masks, you know, when we go into grocery stores or pharmacies and so on. Can one of you kind of give us the reminder as to why we're enacting these measures? And then maybe we can get into some of the sort of specifics of how to do them.
So this is Dr. Keegan. So when we think about how infectious diseases spread, they spread through contact between people. So if the virus doesn't live all that long outside of the human host. We have various estimates from the lab, which range from a couple of minutes on some surfaces to a couple of days on other surfaces. It depends, you know, it's surface dependent. And so the best way that the virus really has of spreading is direct person-to-person contact. So speaking to each other, you know, coughing on each other, those types of things are very effective ways for the virus to spread. And so if you just don't contact other people, you can't potentially get infected from them. And so the best way we have to stop the virus in its tracks is just to reduce the number of people you come into contact with. And I understand that social distancing is difficult. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Things are very uncertain. We want to be around our friends and family. But by doing that, physically being around them, you end up putting people at risk. And so the best thing that we can do is space out. Go on, you know, internet, Zoom, Hangouts, FaceTime, whatever, you know, connect in that regard. But coming into physical contact with another human is really the best way that this virus has to spread. And there, I mean, you can, you know, there are other ways, like if you cough on something in the grocery store, or cough on your hand and then touch a doorknob and somebody else touches the doorknob. But the most effective way is if you just cough directly on somebody else or speaking directly into somebody else's face, you know. And so by minimizing that, you know, we're not perfect. Nobody's ever going to get to zero, especially for the duration that we're going for. But reducing your numbers as best you can for as long as you can is really the best thing that we can ask from people. And we're seeing it's working. We're looking at Utah. Look at Utah and compare it to New York. Look at Utah and compare it to Florida. We're doing a good job, but that means keep going. It doesn't mean let up.
Sure, Dr. Spivak. Yes.
I was going to speak to if you were asking about the new mask.
Yes,
the masking stuff has been utterly confusing.
Sure, I agree.
The messaging has been confusing, and I technically understand it. But the newest recommendations are coming from a increased recognition based on some sort of intensive epidemiologic investigations of clusters of infections in China and Singapore, and some data also in a nursing home in King County, Washington, showing that varying estimates, you know, depends on what you look at, 5 to 15% of transmission in those sort of, again, it's small numbers, but clusters, seems to be from patients, what we're calling pre-symptomatic patients. So there was contact with folks who were not symptomatic when they were in contact with each other, but then who the individual who is believed to be the source subsequently developed symptoms, you know, 1 to 5 days after the groups were together. So the point is an increasing recognition of possibly asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic, so before symptoms develop, transmission. We don't really know exactly because we're not doing broad enough testing. We don't really know how much asymptomatic transmission there is, but you know, the masks were meant to cover that possibility, but also again, like to Dr. Keegan's point, prevent people in close contact if they were speaking or hopefully coughing, they should be staying home, but from exposing other people. So it's not meant to protect you. It's meant to protect people around you. And I would echo, and there is concern, and I believe there's a lot of debate about this recommendation, that it is not meant to replace social distancing. Social distancing is still the most important measure that we can do, and we know it works. The masks were meant to cover those situations when people have to go to a grocery store or a pharmacy for an essentials and to wear a mask at that situation when you're potentially in close contact and can't avoid it.
Can either of you talk about proper mask methods? You know, like we're supposed to be wearing cloth masks and saving the medical masks for those who are in that field. You know, putting them on, cleaning them, making certain that they are effective. Is there any sort of general advice there?
I mean, the general advice is, and it does seem a little bit all over the place. The bottom line is we have resource limitations. We have supply chain limitations. In an ideal world, we'd either have everybody in an N95 mask or everybody in a sort of medical grade surgical mask. We do not have the mask to do that. So the individuals who are most at risk of being in close contact and exposed to somebody with COVID-19 are healthcare workers. And so the reason the recommendation for the general public is to use bandanas or homemade masks, and there are sewing patterns on CDC's website. It is because we need to try and save the most effective masks with filters in them for healthcare workers and others who are at highest risk of contact. I can't speak to 100% accuracy, give you a sense of like how effective the cloth is, but it's less effective, I will say, in general, you know, sort of cotton or other fabrics are probably less effective for sure than the filters and the high grade mask and health grade masks that we use in the hospital setting. But they probably do help to some degree. But I think the main point is people realize it is not a replacement for social distancing. It's not an excuse to go have a party and everyone wear a bandana over their mouth and nose. It's meant to be used if you have to go out for some essential activity in public.
And this is Dr. Keegan. I'll just quickly add to that. So the first thing is it needs to cover your mouth and your nose. I've seen a lot of people pull it down so their nose sticks out. It's not a replacement. You still should not touch your face when you're wearing it. I know I haven't had any time to actually leave the house in the last 3 weeks, but over the summer I was doing some home improvement projects with a face mask and I kept poking at it and pulling at it, and that's going to be worse. You need to put the mask on and not touch the mask. One thing I've seen is people are putting one color material on the inside and one color on the outside, so you know which side is a contaminated side. When you return from one of your trips wearing it, it should probably just go straight into the laundry machine.
I'm looking at the timing here, and I mean, frequency of cleaning, you said throw it right into the wash. I actually did have an interesting listener question on this, which was, can you hang your mask in UV rays of the sun to kill the virus? Will that work? I don't know if anybody can answer that.
I don't know if it'll work. I will tell you, we are, University of Nebraska has done some, and I believe at the University of, we are repurposing, reusing masks because we have to, and there is some UV cleaning of N95s being done. If it's the same rays as the sun, I have to admit, I don't know. It would need to be for, the bigger point would be, you probably want to have it outside for a significant amount of time to have the virus essentially decay or die off.
Well, and likewise, we know it doesn't live that long on surfaces. So if you just leave it in the sun for 3 days without touching it, whether or not there's sun or not, you know, probably that's sufficient.
Right.
Washing it seems to be the more immediate, for sure, way of getting rid
of it. Maybe sew multiple, and you can have one for every day of the week, and you hang it on the clothesline.
Right. I mean, well, we could go into the wide world of masks. I'll provide some links on our website here for those who are interested in trying to find additional information. I have a couple of weirder questions that I'm putting you in a funny position by asking you these questions. But one is the story about a tiger in the Bronx Zoo testing positive for COVID-19. And then in the wake of that, there was some reporting that was kind of odd about house cats being potentially vulnerable, though others say that isn't something to worry about. Do you have anything to say about those two stories, either of you?
I guess I'm a little concerned why we don't have enough tests to test people, and we tested a tiger in the zoo, but that's my main thought on it. Like, probably don't cough on your house pets. I would say that regardless of whether or not your pets can get infected, if a member of your household is sick and you have an animal coming in and out of the room where they're being isolated, that animal is essentially a walking, what we call in healthcare field, fomite, which is, it's a walking vector. It's covered in virus. You know, you want to keep, if one of you is sick in your household, you want to really keep a limit on what's going in and out of that room. So keep your pets away from sick family members.
That seems like good advice. Dr. Spivak, anything about these cats? I mean, I suppose.
I think that's an excellent point, Dr. Keegan. And like, everyone wants to pet the pet.
Yeah, and we get comfort from them.
We've not studied how long it lives on dog hair. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll just keep going. This one's kind of interesting, too. A number of patients have described a sort of peculiar symptom, which is losing their sense of smell or taste. And I was going to play a clip for you, but I can't pull it together on Zoom. Somebody I interviewed, Catherine, who was a positive test for COVID-19, talked about her experience on that front and said that she, you know, couldn't taste the scotch she was drinking, that she was able to taste a couple of days before. Do we have any understanding as yet to why that's happening for some people who get this virus?
This is Dr. Spivak. I don't have a great sense of why that's happening. I will say it's not novel necessary to this respiratory virus or to even inflammation in the nose and mouth. I mean, speaking from personal experience, when I've had a cold, presumably a rhinovirus or even maybe another coronavirus in the past, or even seasonal allergies, again, you don't realize it at first. It's when somebody says, hey, do you smell that burning wood smell or whatever? I'm like, no, what are you talking about? I don't smell it. You know, when you have inflammation, I think in your sinuses and in your nares on a cellular level, I can't tell you why that happens, but it's not totally novel to this virus. I think it is something to clinicians should maybe in this current situation watch for, and it may make it more likely that you want to test somebody.
Sure.
Why it happens, I can't tell you, but again, it's not unique, I don't think, necessarily to this particular virus.
And adding to that, this is Dr. Keegan, it seems to come back. It's not permanent.
And that was the case for this particular interviewee, this patient as well. She said that she was happy to be able to smell the shampoo she was using. So what about lasting effects of the virus? I've read that for some people there might be lung scarring. Would that be from the pneumonia people get or from the virus itself?
So this is Dr. Spivak. I think it's partly a little bit too early to know all the effects. And I tell you, I think there's going to be a lot of them. And it depends on who we're talking about. I think there's going to be some potential mental health side effects, some PTSD. Definitely almost every patient who's left our hospital, again, we're only admitting, I think, hospitalizing about 8 to 10% of all positives in the state. But most of our patients have left the hospital still requiring oxygen. We don't know exactly whether their pneumonia is driven predominantly by viral replication or inflammation response to the virus. And it's probably some combination of both and, you know, predominantly more one than the other in some patients. But there does seem to be a significant amount of inflammation, again, on the hospitalized patients, inflammation in their lungs. And I would suspect there's going to be some chronic lung function impairment from that, some needs for oxygen, for home oxygen for how long, I don't know. Again, it's going to be different a little bit from patient to patient. Many of them are having persistent coughs. So I think there's those concerns, but I would also echo again, the probably very real mental, social isolation, traumatic fallout from this, specifically our patients who are hospitalized for extended periods in the intensive care unit. You know, their families are not able to come see them. The healthcare providers are you know, covered in protective equipment that may seem scary. And so I think that's something that we need to be attuned to, and hopefully, and I have mental health professional colleagues who are already talking about this and thinking about what the sort of ramifications and the long-term consequences of this may be.
That's really interesting. Speaking of the sort of mental health picture, and we will wrap up here in a minute, but how are the two of you doing? How are you coping with the moment in time that we're living through, especially in the work that you're doing?
This is Dr. Spivak. I mean, it's kind of day to day. I mean, I have really nothing to complain about, and I feel almost sort of embarrassed talking about myself. My life is not that difficult. But it's been challenging, Mark, partly just for the reasons I just sort of talked about. Watching some of these cases from a distance and watching some of these patients has been a little bit difficult. But I do feel like I'm in a better place, to be honest with you, than I was a week or two ago, because it's kind of like the adrenaline has come down, and this is like a new normal that I have adjusted to. You know, and I've got kids that are homeschooling, and it's sort of like we figured everything out. The unknown is the very hard part. And I'm sure Dr. Keegan gets the same questions, if not more than me. Like you asked when we started, what's going to happen? I get questions about family vacation. Should I cancel? What are we going to do about this or that? And I always try and give a fairly cautious answer about we don't know. And it probably nothing's going to go back to normal until we have a vaccine. But the unknown is the hardest part, I think.
Thank you. Dr. Keegan?
Yeah, so I'm actually finding that work is a little easier than not working. So I've been working between 16 and 20 hour days, and I just don't even have time to think about the personal aspects of this. And while I thought that was really hard, yesterday I tried to take a break and it sort of all sunk in. I mean, my husband lost his job earlier in the month. And my parents, I'm originally from Florida. My parents are over 60 and live in Florida. My younger sister lives in the hardest hit neighborhood of Brooklyn. And so, you know, thinking of all of that, it's actually harder than thinking about, you know, at least when I'm working, I'm able to do something useful. I'm able to help with the state response. And so I've actually been just trying to completely avoid taking breaks at this point, which is, it's mentally very challenging to work that long, but I'm actually finding it even harder to step back and, you know, not work. I really empathize with, you know, other people who don't have work to distract them. You know, I know a lot of people are struggling to be productive right now in whatever it is they're trying to do because of the absolute chaos that's going around the globe right now. And I feel sometimes lucky that my work is so intensive that I don't have the chance to think about it.
Wow, you're the opposite of the rest of us who are supposed to take breaks from thinking about it. You're the person
yeah.
who gets solace from consistently thinking about it. That's really interesting.
But thinking about the part that I can influence, right? Like I'm building models that states are using to guide their response. So by doing that, I feel like I'm actually being useful and being helpful. You know, by thinking about the things I can do to help, it helps avoid thinking about the part that you don't have any control over, which is what's terrifying for all of us, is handling the unknowns.
Wow. Well, speaking of useful and helpful, two useful and helpful people that I've been speaking with for the past half hour, Emily Spivak, Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases with University of Utah Health, and Lindsay Keegan, Epidemiologist at the University of Utah School of Medicine. Thank you both for making time for this. I know it's a busy time for both of you, so really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That does it for In the Hive from KCPW 88.3 FM, Salt Lake Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Thank you very much for listening. Please join us again soon. And of course, please stay safe.